Well, a good day to everyone in KGVM land, Bozeman, Gallatin Valley, Montana, Treasure State. Welcome to The View From Here. I'm Steve Kirkhoff, and along with my good friend Jeff Milchin, we are lucky to have Kelly Wiseman in the studio. You might know Kelly as a longtime fixture, general manager of Bozeman's Community Food Co-op. We've invited Kelly to come and join us in a conversation about the profound impacts of COVID-19 on our nation's food system and the impacts that it's having locally. Having worked in the sustainable food industry for more than 30 years, Kelly brings a thorough understanding of food systems to our investigation into the highly vulnerable meatpacking industry, which will be our focus, to outbreaks of COVID-19 virus. A native of Great Falls, Kelly has been a Bozeman resident since 1984. I didn't even think he was alive then. And an employee of the co-op since 1989. He's civic-minded. Kelly has volunteered over the years to serve on a variety of city and county and other advisory boards, including the City County Planning Board, the Board of the Food Bank and Bridger Bowl, City Planning Board, and City Parking Commission, among others. We thank Kelly for his many positive contributions to our community and welcome him to KGVM Bozeman 95.9.
Howdy, good to be here.
So today, Kelly and Jeff, I'd like to begin our conversation into, I guess you might say, the vulnerability of our food system. First, we'll start off with what I think are a few facts. The pattern of outbreaks of the COVID-19 virus has exposed weaknesses in American society at large. And among the hardest hit communities in our country are those of the poor and racial minorities, particularly Hispanics and Black communities, where unemployment is highest and social safety nets have the least benefit. Also bearing the brunt of the pandemic are, of course, frontline workers, medical and emergency personnel. After frontline medicine, three different sectors of society are acknowledged as providing hotspots for COVID outbreaks: prisons, nursing homes, and meatpacking plants. It is this last sector, meatpacking plants, including poultry, that I'd like to begin discussing with you today, Kelly. So, Kelly, I'm not sure where to begin because it's a big tangle, and we're in a constantly set of moving variables when we try to get a handle on how to conduct ourselves in this pandemic. But to your knowledge, is the vulnerability of workers to infection of the COVID virus, is this unique to the U.S., or is this something that you have observed or heard about or know about happening, say, in the European Union or other places and parts of the world?
Well, there's a big outbreak in Ireland right now. There's a packing plant there that supplies the food to actually all the McDonald's burgers in Europe. So if you can put your brain around the scale, that's about 400 million beef patties a year that they produce. The rest of Europe has not been too bad. And the reason for that is that in Europe, the consolidation of the processing industry has not been nearly the scale it has been in the United States. Right. So in Europe, in the United States, the top three meat processing companies control about 75% of the market, right? So that's Cargill, it's JBS, somebody else, I can't remember right now. They control about 3/4. And that started happening back in the 80s. They started basically merging, consolidating, buying up various processors, and then they started building these enormous plants. Like the one that the Smithfield plant that went down famously in South Dakota. You know, if you can kind of put your head around, they process 10,000 pigs a day in that plant, and they have about 1,000 people working at any one time, right? In Europe, it doesn't work that way at nearly the same scale. The top 15 companies in Europe only control about 1/3 of the business. So in Europe, they have a lot of regional meat processors, whether it's small butcher shops or regional meat facilities like we have one in Columbus, we have Pioneer Meats in Big Timber, we have a few of them around, not very many in Montana, and over the years they've been getting absorbed or run out of business by these big players. So that's why in America it's a lot more of a hotbed of infestation, frankly, than in Europe.
So is that Is that fact of life, the concentration of ownership of the meat processing and packing industry, is that a critique? Or, because what I've always been told is that that's what creates efficiency, and efficiency is what keeps prices down, which makes it possible for more people to have healthier diets.
Yeah.
So is it both? Is it either or? How do you?
I think it's that? In a weird way, it's kind of both, right? We have Americans. Well, it kind of goes back to World War II. After World War II, our agriculture industry obviously was unscathed. And for the most part, our country was unscathed economically. In fact, was in a boom. We were, with the Marshall Plan, helping to feed Europe. Europeans were starving, right? So while they were starving, we invented fast food, right? We started the burger thing. We started fried chicken, you know, all that stuff to go. And it sort of ramped up the notion that Americans should eat a lot more meat and the meat should be cheap. And that never became a thing in Europe. Or Asia, really anywhere else. It became an American, really a North American thing, was you should have meat with almost every meal. It's an expectation. That's where your protein should come from, not from beans and rice, right? That's what people south of the border eat, right? We should have some meat on every plate, right? And it needs to be cheap. So in order to get it cheap, they did these giant processing. The facilities got bigger, and they merged. What that does is a couple things. It enables the processors to dictate the pricing they give to ranchers, whether it's people that are raising hogs or people that are raising cattle. They no longer have any kind of flex room on what they charge, because they're dealing with a very small amount of very huge corporations, right? The Smithfield Company is a wholly owned subsidiary of a Chinese company, actually. It's not even American. And so if you're growing hogs for them, they dictate the price.
Not only that, but am I correct in the way I understood a certain story that I was reading about the fact that many producers of pigs, they are having to euthanize many animals because the way that the processing facilities are designed, they only take a certain dimension of animal through with the system.
Correct.
So when you put it on the belt and you start cutting it up, it can't be larger than X. And the more that these pigs are not brought to a processing facility, the bigger they get, and they're no longer tenable to put through the system.
Yep.
Is that true?
Yep. And if you think about a stream of animals, 10,000 a day, right? That's what, you know, that gets backed up real quick. If instead of having 1,000 workers available to work, you only have 100, it backs it up. The other thing that happens is that those... it's such specialized work, the cutting that they're actually doing, that they're doing such giant volume. That's the reason they work in such close proximity, right? And in fact, it always even goes down to how they handle the airflow in these plants, because the idea in the plants is they keep the air moving, right? So the viruses and other things don't really kind of settle out. Problem is that it keeps it off the meat, but it blows it right into the workers' mouths. And that's one reason the outbreak is harder. That's a theory right now, but they think the airflow in those meat plants is a contributing factor as well.
Well, it's also expensive to air condition a big building, so they have a huge economic incentive to keep them as small and as tightly packed as possible.
Yeah,
right?
If you got a 200,000 square foot floor, right? You'd much rather only have to refrigerate 100,000 square foot floor.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you mentioned the consolidation. I think JBS Corporation also is foreign-owned by a Brazilian company,
correct.
Right? So
yes.
When we're talking about the government stepping in to give immunization from liability for any reckless behavior that causes employees to contract COVID and die, we're talking about supporting transnational corporations that aren't even based in the United States for the most part.
That's right. JBS got in the 2018... farm relief package, they got about $22 million of taxpayer money, right? And they're Brazilian. They were started, actually it was a rancher who, when they started the capital Brasilia back in the day, whatever that was in the late 60s, realized there was going to be a market. And so he started selling and consolidating and just grew and grew and grew. And so now they are actually the largest meat packer of beef anyway in the United States.
Who decides that these facilities are too unsafe? Because obviously we expect, and I suppose when you go to medical school, you have the anticipation that there will be a day when you will put yourself in harm's way to do your job. Right. That's an anticipation, that's an expectation when you're going and getting trained up in medical school and doing your residency. You know you'll be in the presence of contagious diseases and infectious diseases. That's a part of what you sign up for. Can we say that the same is true to some extent for people who decide to get a job working at a meatpacking plant?
Yeah, they're not trained for that kind of hazard. They didn't sign up to be heroes, right? You know, and they're in harm's way. Many of them are low income. There's a lot of people, refugees from other countries, right? I was hearing a thing on the radio the other day from a really interesting story of a woman who was an orphaned by terrorists in South Sudan and ended up eventually making her way to the United States and raising a family. And she was in that Smithfield plant and she herself got sick and almost died from it, right? So it's a, I don't, you know, the question who decides, to me, ultimately, in some ways, there could be some legislation to address this, certainly should be in terms of worker safety. I also think that in some way it maybe have to be led, like a lot of things, by our shopping dollars, right? That's where the organic movement came from. Was it wasn't that somebody decided that it'd be really cool to do this thing. It's because a lot of people started looking at a different way of thinking about food and agriculture, and that's why our focus has been on our meat supply at the co-op is it's regional, local, and regional. We don't buy out of what we call the meat pipe, right? The beef pipeline or the big pork pipeline, in part because we think of the different model is far more healthy for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. Please go ahead, Jeff.
So, Kelly, can you tell us a little bit about when you walk into the co-op to buy pork, beef, chicken, other meats? Where are those processed? Where are they coming from? And why can people feel more confident that that's going to be safe for them and better for the workers that are involved in the process?
The our pork is raised in by a guy named John Smith over at, in Whitehall area, south of Whitehall, Montana. And then we live haul it, actually, on trailers. If anybody needs a job, let me know. We're looking for a new driver. But we live haul hogs to Big Timber, to Pioneer Meats, where a guy named Ryan owns it. He started it. He built this place himself. It's USDA approved. And he processes our meats for us. The that's where our sausage comes from. That's where the bacon comes from, right? And then he ships it back over to us. The beef, most of our beef comes from also the Big Timber area. B-Bar is they're in Big Timber and then up in Paradise Valley. They're a certified organic operation. We do have some other sort of regional beef that we do, but we learn that our people not only want local, but they also want organic, typically. And Wes has an organic operation. So he also hauls his cattle to Pioneer Meats in Big Timber, where it's processed and then comes to us. Right. The chicken supply is more challenging. We do smart chickens. They're coming out of Nebraska. They're an operation that they make a lot of guarantees and do a lot of public inspections of their facility. So we know that they're... it's a lot more humane method. The chickens actually get sunlight. They're not living in cages. You know, they're not, and that's why they're a little more expensive. But that's we haven't been able to find a local or even a regional chicken supplier that can handle the volume that we go through.
Right? Why do you think that is, Kelly?
Montana's cold is part of it. It's chilly. It's one of those things where nobody, I think, grows up and says, I want to be a chicken farmer. You know, I think it's a family passed along in families more than that. And so there's a real tradition of it in other parts of the country and not in Montana. It was tradition here is, you know, has been beef on the range. Right.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, when I hear you talk about the way that the meat comes to the co-op, it cheers me. It warms the cockles of my heart because that's the reason why I've been a co-op member for, I don't know, a couple decades, mm-hmm. because of the faith that I put, and I think it's well-earned faith and trust in people like yourself mm-hmm. and other buyers who do this kind of legwork to inspect how the meat is being raised and how it's being processed and take a part in it and don't let it become mega scale. So I really appreciate that. And you know, as we talk about some of the risks that are inherent to the industrial model of supplying meat to Americans, obviously COVID presents us with an opportunity to reflect and to reform, mm-hmm. or to scuttle altogether and try to start out doing more of along the lines of what the co-op is doing. But mm-hmm. when you look at the problems that are inherent in that mega system, right now the flashpoint is the illnesses and the susceptibility to COVID. Is this moment of reflection for us one in which we should be thinking, well, the industrial system is here to stay. It's a part of globalized capitalism. What we need to do is reform it. We need to space out workers. We need to make a safer workplace. We need to slow down the belt so that people are doing fewer animals per hour. That's going to perhaps put a dent in their profits, or I don't know. Is that the kind of approach that you think is sort of like the first step when we confront this system, which is causing illness and putting people in harm's way?
Well, I definitely think that there needs to be some pretty serious reform requirements in processing facilities in terms of spacing of workers, in terms of working conditions and all that. You know, if you think back when they first did that with the meat processing plants in Chicago, right, after The Jungle came out, and it was a whole awareness for people that, oh my gosh, this is really a terrible, people are falling into vats and they're not turning off the machine and out the sausage goes, right? Well, they've done a lot of work on that since then, and they have made it a lot safer in terms of the actual quality of the food. But one of the most dangerous working jobs is working in these plants, and that's been the case for a long time. And I think that the argument always is, well, then the food's just going to get really expensive, right? And Americans demand cheap food. A lot of people have to have affordable food because they're low income, right? Or they low income and they have a couple of kids. And so it'd be easy to say, well, you just need to raise all the prices. Like, so there's the tension there. The other food company, I couldn't remember the top three of the meat processors in the country, is Tyson, right? Well, John Tyson is a billionaire. So is there any room in this industry for some more of the money to go down instead of up? And that's, I think, we're going to be examining, hopefully, a lot of things in our society around that. And the food industry is no exception to that. There really is a lot of money going to the top. A lot of people getting wealthy out there. And then they just argue, well, yeah, but we have to keep the food really cheap. And the place where the razor's edge on the margin is in the grocery stores and for the actual producers themselves, the ranchers. That's where it's super tight. Past that, the money tends to flow more expansively in the food industry. And that's why you can have, you don't see a lot of billionaire ranchers, but you see a billionaire who runs food processing, right? And that's true with the Cargill family as well. That's a privately owned company, not publicly traded, and they're uber rich. So I think we all need to have sort of a reshuffle and rethinking about it a little bit. I really believe that the industrial aspect of agriculture is not going to go away because we have too many people to feed. Okay? Small regional stuff like we do, though, there's a lot of room for it to grow in a big way.
Do you think, but you said that the industrial giantism is probably here to stay, but what if there was, what if we just, for some reason, there was a policy that we were going to devolve all food to sort of a localism, right? That's what the model of the co-op was going to be duplicated, mm-hmm. in all places where it was at all tenable, right? Would it be possible? Could you imagine a world without a Smithfield plant in South Dakota processing 10,000 animal days? Could you imagine the poor? Could you imagine the unemployed? Could you imagine the disabled? Could you imagine the marginalized people of this nation still being able to eat meat in a world in which the industry was devolved to localism?
I do. I think that it would be a strain in some obviously large metropolitan areas. However, there's a lot of land that's being used in terms of agriculture that's inefficient and on a scale of you know, how much alfalfa do we need and to what end, rather than grass-fed open range beef, you know, production. So I think that I think there needs to be a mix. I think that I would love to believe that we could move to this, you know, all regional production. It's possible. There's certainly a lot of room for more small-scale local growers, but it's not incentivized yet, right? And that gets to the food bill, the farm bill. That gets to the, you know, the omnivore's dilemma, all the stuff that Paul was writing about, thinking that the notion that most of our energy goes into producing low-calorie foods, and that's what we supplement. And so our local organic farmers who are really wonderful and good at what they do, they don't get much out of the farm bill, right? They have to spend a lot of money to do organic certification. John Tester did get some stuff in the last farm bill for farmers that want to transition to organics and get some support for that. But beyond that, most of the money goes to a place that is inefficient and causes obesity. And so, like, you can look at meat, but you also have to look at carbohydrates and veggies as to, for the whole mix of this thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where actually a lot of the meat consumption could probably rest a little bit if it weren't being offset by so much carbohydrate consumption. Right, you know, one of the things that people are getting sick is because a lot of them are obese in America. A lot of obesity is a major factor in this disease, and it's directly prompted, propped up, and kind of paid for by our farm bill every 10 years.
Mm. Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that so much of health obviously depends upon what we eat.
Yeah.
And so much of illness in the COVID situation is also sort of pivoting around the food supply system mm-hmm. that we have in our country. How much self-reflection have you seen on the part of producers, American consumers, just everybody, during this sort of staying at home, self-quarantining period of time in which there is an opportunity for people to stop and to think? Do you sense that happening?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask one kind of related thing to pile on to that. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like what's going on presently is leading more people to cook from scratch more, to use less prepared foods, and is that going to play any healthy role in the process?
We certainly see it, right? We're selling our basket size at the co-op, the average transaction has tripled. People are buying big carts of, and they're buying a lot of veggies and, you know, potatoes and stuff to cook at home. So I kind of hope that is a new trend, frankly. I'm in a little bit of a weird position on this, because I see people when they're at their kind of vulnerable coming out of this thing in the food store. And, you know, I've never seen more gratitude on the part of our members and shoppers for our frontline workers, which I think is great. I think that's a piece of this that's a reflection part that's different. You know, it's like every job is important now in people's minds because they actually had a big slap in the face wake-up call of how vulnerable everybody is in the food supply or in the healthcare system or whatever, right? Whether that continues afterwards and people are reflective, I hope so, because I mean, I'd love it if we're past it and it's all going to be great now. But a lot of other people, I think it's going to keep being a part of our life for the next year. And I worry about this. I worry about not just the I worry about the stress of it on people's mental health and the workers as much as anything. Right. That's a big piece. It's scary for them.
You worry about it because you've noticed things.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I've had, you know, I didn't used to have people that couldn't come into work because of anxiety, you know, and we've done, I think, as much as anybody to try and protect our workers in our stores, but it's they're really scared. And it's tenored by people saying, thank you for being here. There's a real humanity that's going on that I think is great. And I hope that same thoughtfulness of thanking a worker that you know is possibly putting their health on the line, I hope that same thoughtfulness goes to your question about thinking a little bit more about where our food comes from and you know, how tenuous the thread is. Those of us in the food business have known for a long time, right? We had two avalanches on I-90 a couple of winters ago, and it shut down the food supply for a day. People didn't notice it but all the trucks were stopped. There was no food coming into Bozeman. And we were like not telling anybody, like, you don't say anything, because there goes the toilet paper again, right? Right? But it's real tenuous. The next outbreaks are going to be, by the way, in the fish processing plants up in Alaska. Watch out, we're going to run out of salmon. Okay, there's going to be...
Do you say this with some sort of insider knowledge?
You could say that. You could say that. Yeah, you know.
Stock up today.
Some of the shortages are because of lack of packaging. Hmm. Right? That's what's happened to milk. It's not that there's no milk out there, but we're running low on milk because Organic Valley is running short on packaging.
You mean containers?
Huh? Mm-hmm. Yep.
And why were the container plants shut down?
They weren't shut down, but they were overwhelmed. Mm. Right? When your volume goes up 600% or whatever it did, you know, bam, all at once.
Was that unique to the organic milk industry?
Nope, everybody. And that's why there's various waves of out of stock. You know, people say, are we past this now? It's like, no, not really. Because, the chicken flocks, this is what's funny about the organic industry, right? Every first week of May, we run low on chickens, because that's when they swap out their pullets in the spring. Okay, a lot of the factory eggs don't do that on that kind of basis, but the organic production stream, that's what they do. Okay, whether it's packaging, who knows if we're going to start running short on truckers? You know, you guys probably follow that news early on. That was a thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think these waves are going to continue in the meat packing plants for sure. I don't think that's going to let up.
So do you have some kind of keen insights when you walk around the co-op floor and you look at the shelves and you see that there's been a run on lentils or split peas or there's no more olive oil? I mean, are you like interpreting people's behavior just from the appearance or disappearance of items on the shelves?
Yeah, and it is interesting. You never knew. I don't think anybody anticipated that we were going to run out of baking yeast. Yeah, right? And I can't get it.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, somebody said, saw an ad somewhere online or something for 20 pounds of baking yeast. And I was like, dude, put it in 2 ounce packages. You'll make a serious bake. Right. But for us, we saw, you know, when the first case happened in Washington State, we bought a pallet of toilet paper, a pallet of canned beans and a pallet of rice. I said, load in on that stuff. We're going to, and they're like, my buyers were like, why toilet paper? I'm like, don't ask. I know my people. Just get the TP in here, okay? And you know, now, of course, we've run through. We're the last store to run out of TP, but we did, right? So we're trying to anticipate what's next. Well, the great news is, so far, nothing has happened to the fresh veggie supply. But, you know, you probably follow the news that the farm workers are riding buses to work. You know, they are taking breaks together. A lot of them live communally, and nobody wants to do that work. So that's another place where, like all the carrots, like 80% of the carrots in America come from two farms in California. And those farms are so big that they move around the farm by aircraft. That's how big the carrot operations are. It's in the southern Central Valley, right? You know, the bunny love carrots and all that. They invented baby carrots. Because they're like, well, what can we do to really make money on this? And like, well, let's get rid of the most nutritious part, and let's have this little core, and it'll be a snack food. It's like, good idea, bam! And they invented that, right? So, I think that we could. I'm most concerned right now about the supply chain of veggies coming here, because we have a lot of good local veggies in summer, and you know, the co-op, we go through 500,000 pounds of it just in our food service alone, but it's a pretty tenuous thread. Just about everything is coming out of the Central Valley in California or in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of linkage between your local farmers and fruit and vegetable producers and like helping average citizens who live on city lots but have enough ground to plant maybe some of their own vegetables in their backyard but don't have any know-how, have never done it, but now in the face of all this uncertainty, they might think about putting some seed in the ground? Is there any sort of training? Is there any, like, someone wants to learn how to do a garden, you can just get the YouTube video, no doubt.
Yeah.
But are there any linkages between...
I don't believe there are. I know that there's I think a lot of the local growers, a pretty important educational piece that they're doing. Becky Weed just, I think, got a hold of a whole lot more acreage adjoining her place. to facilitate training new young farmers, and because that's a huge piece in the local regional food chain, is making it so that the knowledge is there and then also affordable acreage is available.
Right.
Now that could be that's the sort of land use issue that I would think it'd be very helpful for city and county to get behind and think about that. We're all about parks and trails, which is great, but we're not really about farm support.
Hmm.
And there's an awful lot of land that could be used for to make that length less tenuous for getting carrots or potatoes or whatever, right?
Just want to take a moment to remind folks you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, Montana, and broadcasting online from KGVM.org.
So, Kelly, what if worst case scenario were to come true and meatpacking slowed to almost a halt? And same thing, because I gathered from what you said that the flip side of food production, the fruits and vegetables, is also on the industrial model.
Yes.
So if both sides, if both the fruits and vegetables and the meats were to just dry up, what would happen to Gallatin County? What would happen to people here?
Well, people would start looking for seeds pretty quick, you know. I've tried not to be too much of a doomsdayer around the food supply because it's really scary if you really start to think about how armed this valley is. And there are people, I'll just go shoot a deer. It's like, really? You think there's 40,000 deer around here for everybody to, you know? So I think it could get pretty hairy. I think that this COVID-19 thing is a dry run for climate change, right? In the food system. It's the disruption that we're seeing right now that's a dress rehearsal for what could easily happen with climate change, whether it's drought or fires or whatever, you know. And so hopefully it's a Kickstarter for people to really start thinking about that, growing their own food. Or like I remember we did it when I was on the food bank board, we did a community garden, and we had some land and good soil for irrigation, and it was ready for people. But the problem was the clients of the food bank are low income, and they didn't have time to garden, really. A lot of them had two jobs and kids, yeah. Right? So it didn't really work for them that easily. So there's a tension there. There's always the income tension, I think, that's real and we can't ignore. You know, I have time and can do it, but not everybody can. But I still think that you know, there's a lot of places where we should have more community gardens and throughout the country. Getting back to the question you asked a while back, whether it's hydroponics or outdoor or greenhouses, I think there's definitely a need for it. And of course, I've felt that way for 30 years, and now it's coming. It feels like it's coming home to roost. I don't know. I hope people, when this is all over, I hope this is sunk in and it's enough of a. Enough of an eye-opener that people really take it to heart.
Well, right. Speaking of that, for things to sink in, it can happen independently, each person, you know, on his or her their own thinking thoughts and reflecting on how they conduct their business, their lives, what they eat, etc. Where do you go to find inspiration? What have you been reading? What sources of sort of enlightenment have you come across during this time? Because as I read and I get the news feed and I try to find things that are not just strictly mainstream, what have you found that you could pass on to me, because I'm interested in, to listeners, that has been in some sense enlightening or inspirational or motivational in terms of how we can respond in a responsible way to this pandemic?
Well, as far as in terms of food stuff, you know, I follow a fair amount of the trade publications, and so I listen to what people are saying in co-ops and not co-ops and everywhere. As far as my own personal life, frankly, I a little earlier in this administration, I decided that I really needed to just spend some more time reading about geologic time. Right? I reread John McPhee.
How has that helped?
It's helped a lot, actually, from a perspective standpoint. I just finished the book about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. Right? Because I thought, okay, we're in cataclysmic times. How have other people had to respond to things, right? And so that may sound horribly depressing. On the other hand, it was inspirational because the community of San Francisco came together, and instantly people from all over the state were bringing in food. There was really no federal supply chain, but they, as you know, people from LA started sending food north. LA was really teeny at the time in 1906. They started sending food to the big city, San Francisco, because there was so much compassion for those people. And I kind of hold out hope on that. I think that, you know, there's that talk about whether you're a weaver or not these days, you know, whether you're...
What's a weaver?
A weaver is a person who views this catastrophe as a chance for us to come together and support each other. Right, so the people, sure. The people howling at 8 o'clock, the people out the windows in New York City at 7 o'clock, to you know, people making masks. We couldn't get masks, right? And I needed masks. I mean, I ordered 1,000 masks like March 10th or something, and they kept putting me off. So I just put it out to the public, and bam, we had like 300 masks show up in 2 days. And wow. You right, and you know, including this one that I have right here, right?
Who made those?
Just people in the public. There's the there's people. Masks for Heroes is a Bozeman Facebook group. I first applied to them, and they said no because they were really, and rightfully so, they were trying to get masks for people and medical folks, right? Not necessarily people medical grade masks, but receptionists. Mm. You know, people doing the ambulance driving, whatever, cops. Firefighters, right? Mm-hmm. So about a week later, people started bringing bags of masks in, and we washed them and handed them out to our crew. So our workers all got masks that way. That I think that's really hopeful in this. That's a small example, but I think it's going forward, as long as we... I mean, it troubles me that there's going to be a very divisive and angry election coming up, of course. But the flip side of that is, coming out of it, I hope people have, I hope it has spawned a little more humanity from people.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to Steve's question. Solutions Journalism Network is one great source for the kind of positive news stories that I've been paying attention to recently. And yeah, that's an interesting observation, Kelly. I mean, the natural inclination of human beings is to band together and support each other in crisis, I think. And it seems like, you know, it was almost a gift to the Trump administration to have this in a certain sense. Politically, it was a slam dunk that they managed to fumble into the stands by turning it into a partisan issue.
Yeah.
Whether or not you're doing your part to fight COVID is now seen as somehow a partisan flag rather than a community-centric
yeah.
vision.
Yeah.
But we probably shouldn't go into that terrain too deeply. Let me route things to a conversation around co-ops and the opportunity for community-owned food systems, because the Bozeman co-op is one of the most successful in the country, and certainly I know you won't say it, but I know a lot of it is because it's a very well-run business operation. Mm-hmm. But are there other factors that can help communities kind of use this crisis as an opportunity to either start a new co-op or community-owned grocery store of some form to strengthen existing locally owned stores and kind of reverse the trend of corporatization of food at the retail level?
Yes, the answer is yes. The challenge, of course, is for food co-ops, we are in the land of the giants, you know? And so until people are willing to let go of strictly shopping on price, it's hard for small startup co-ops to make it. Now, our national co-op chain, National Co-op Grocers, we have a good supply contract, and so we can get really good cost of goods for really small co-ops. So somebody does a small co-op in a small town in Minnesota, or for that matter, Montana, they could get a better cost of goods on there than an independent grocery store can. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's because we have a national chain, we have about a couple billion dollars in buying power and so forth. Will this do that? I don't know, Jeff. I think that the opportunity is certainly there. I know that some co-ops are really struggling in this thing because the amount of food service that they were depending on as part of their model. On the other hand, we are hearing a lot of the feedback we're getting is about how much people seem to value that it's a group of people coming together and making something happen. right? So I think it is a possibility. I think it's definitely an opportunity, but I don't know. It's capital is the thing. It's about the capital, and it's hard to start a food store if there's a roaring recession or depression on. Many of them we started as a food buying group, right? People were just buying food together, right, and they made it happen. We have four new co-ops that startups this year in the nation that are now in our group all over the place, and they're doing $2 to $5 million a year. And, you know, just their community said, yeah, we want one, let's do it. So we did create a how to start a food co-op manual, and we have teams of people that go in and assist nationwide to do that work. So there is some backbone there to the movement.
And what does the national trend look like in terms of new co-op startups and this average sales of co-ops over, say, the last couple of decades?
Well, the co-ops, we had really a banner. Our banner year was about 3 years ago. And then what happened was a lot of what co-ops sell became available in grocery stores. And then there was a lot of regional chains that came in and frankly beat up a fair amount of co-ops pretty bad. Lucky's Market, which went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Moment of silence. Sprouts, you know, the whole bunch of them out there. So right now, our growth rate on co-ops is about 3% a year, which is better than the conventional chains. But it's not. We were at 7% about 3 or 4 years ago. So it has actually slowed down a bit. Going into this crisis, it has slowed down a bit. Where it goes now, I don't know. You know, I'd love to be aspirational and say people are going to want to buy from the local co-op, and they're not going to, you know, they're going to turn away from Safeway or whoever it is. But I'm not sure I'm really that optimistic. The average person.
Were you saying just a moment ago that certain items that I can now find at Safeway were formerly only found in local co-ops?
Yeah. Yes.
So some of the good stuff's been mainstream.
Organics, for sure, and a lot of the organic companies, you know, have been bought by big conventionals.
And is that in a reliable way? When I go to, let's say, Rose Hours, and I'm in the meat section, and it says certified USDA organic, do I have the same certainty that I'm getting a scrupulously raised and packaged product comparable to what's available in the Bozeman?
Generally pretty good if it says organic. What they do is I'm not trying to pick on any individual stores or chains, but what a lot of them do is they make it look like it's organic, but it's not. So they'll have a sign that says organic on the wall, for example, or something, but then underneath like they had a case when one of the stores remodeled and reopened that said organic shrimp. I'm like, where'd you get organic shrimp, brah? You know, like, I still can't find certified organic shrimp anywhere. You know, what are you talking about? Organic, though, the organic program is good. It's pretty solid. Even, you know, there's been places where some players have screwed up and done some goofy stuff. They've generally gotten caught. There's a lot of watchdogs on the organics, whereas it can be a little more, I would say, loose, way more loose is when people use words like natural. Or no added hormones. No one's looking at that.
Is there a legal definition to the use of the word natural?
There is a legal definition, but it's super loose.
Mm-hmm.
It's super loose. I think it's actually more of a guideline than a legal definition. It's nothing like organics. I mean, organic, that word is owned by the USDA. Mm-hmm. You can't slap it on. I can't say organic coffee bar unless everything in it is organic, right? But they use words like natural. They say free range. You know, they say all these sound, feel-good terms that it's pretty easy to fool people into thinking something's clean. No one's checking. When they say no added antibiotics or hormones, absolutely no one checks that. There's not enough staffing in the USDA.
That's not part of the organic word.
No. Nope. It's just organic, and or if it's 85% in the package, you can say made with organic ingredients. There's some real stringent guidelines. And by the way, people go, oh, organics and from Mexico or China. They're actually pretty good, actually, overseas in Washington, too, because organics are really important to Mexican agriculture. they take it super seriously down there. Right? Mm-hmm. They don't want it. They don't want the word, you know, for it suddenly to be seen as that they're lying. You know, so that I actually have pretty high trust and faith in a lot of those other companies or countries because of that. Right.
So one question for you, Kelly. Obviously, it'd be great to have more people coming to visit from the co-op from your perspective, I'm sure. But for people in our listening area who are living in Livingston, Belgrade, Ennis, other communities, what do you know about what some of the best choices people can make for getting their food from within their own communities who care about some of the things we're talking about here today and other communities in the Gallatin Valley?
Well, I would definitely say look for local growers, you know, in season. The farmers make more money when they sell direct to the customer than they make when they sell to me. Right. And so that's great. And we strongly encourage that. You know, a lot of the farmers markets have become kind of crafts fairs, but there's still growers there. And, you know, go there and buy. Right. There's some small natural food stores in places that you've mentioned. There's also, you know, some of the regional small IGAs and other stores. They do sell local product. You just got to kind of look for it. They don't have it in the best spots usually. They also sell organic, certified organic, and I would encourage people to look for that just because I'm a believer in that type of agriculture. But there's a lot of options for buying direct from growers, too.
Apart from the difficulty of having enough capital and wherewithal to start your own food co-op, would you say that these are good times for food co-ops? I mean, if these are good times, because I see you nodding yes, do you project that to continue should the shockwave of COVID continue to rock the meatpacking industry?
I would say good times, yes and no. The yes part is it's, you know, we just started an online service and it's way ahead of expectations. We were going to do it in a year and we did it in 2 weeks, right? And we call it Kogo, and Kogo is rocking, right? Great. Curbside pickup.
That's when you come in your car, pick up what you've already ordered on online.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's working great. And a lot of co-ops are doing that. Some co-ops in areas in hot zones close their doors completely and it's all curbside. And some of them don't have the software that we have to do that. So that people are calling in.
Is there delivery as well? If you don't have a car, you can't get out of your house.
Yeah, some of them are doing that. Some of them, you call in and they just sort of write down what what you describe.
That's how my mother used to do when I was a kid. Ernie Heap would pick up the phone on the other end. Yes, Carolyn?
there's now a resurgence in glass bottled milk delivery. Right? In the cities. That's starting to happen. A lot of weird things are happening. As far as food co-ops, it's so the sales are up in a lot of things, the easiest part of our business. Okay? Grocery, produce, those are the easiest part of our business. Food service is the hardest because we cook from scratch. We don't open bags and dump it into a bowl. We cook it all from scratch, right? That's the hardest thing, and that's the part that collapsed, and that's really stressful. I've been on a number of calls with other general managers lately where people are pretty close to in tears over the stress level. Right now, the stress level of the disease and possibility in the stores, workers getting sick, workers being afraid. The supply chain is still super gnarly. So all of a sudden, there's no TP or there's no milk or, you know, what I was saying before.
Is that result of a lack of production or just the sort of unpredictability of consumer behavior?
It's behavior. People acted surprised. That's why we loaded in all the extra food that we did, because you know, when they said, what should we do? The advice was, well, be ready to stay home for 2 or 3 weeks and quarantine with your family. It's like, well, if you have two teenagers and you're going to buy for three
That's
weeks.
A lot of ice cream.
You know, it's like our sales, like more than doubled for a week that starting on March 12th. And then it's just what that does in the supply chain is just overwhelms everything. And so the wholesalers started buying more, everything they could get their hands on from the manufacturers. It started jam ups at their loading docks. So trucks were actually waiting a day to unload at UNFI in Portland area. And, you know, so that ripple effect was like a huge amount of sales. And then honestly, when everybody went into quarantine, our sales plummeted, went way down. Well, I still have all these staff that to pay and take care of. And my sales went from, you know, it'd be whatever, 70,000 a day down to 20,000 a day.
Was the co-op eligible for bailout money?
Yeah, we were. We got some. We don't know how much of it on the PPP is going to be forgiven or not. We still haven't been told that. So we're using it to give people hazard pay and to pay all our payroll for the next it's an 8-week thing that we get, and then if we have to pay it back, we have, I think, 2 years to pay it back. So it's challenging.
So, you know, with the supply chain question you asked, Steve, I know, you know, with toilet paper, it's been kind of the most widely reported example, but there's a real difference between the supply chain, between the stuff that people typically use in their homes and the big rolls that a lot of workplaces use, airports, and countless other facilities. So that's part of the problem too, right, Kelly? That the supply chain isn't necessarily the same to deliver goods to the co-op as it was to deliver to restaurants and hospitals, for example.
That's exactly true. And incidentally, people wonder about TP. It's like, you know, people were hoording it, but it's also worth knowing that there's just not much inventory on toilet paper at any one time because it's a big volume, low price item. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot, just like the
you
idea.
You want to fill a warehouse with toilet paper.
Fill a warehouse with toilet paper. Like, no, you want to fill a warehouse with, you know, canned tuna, you know? So that's why that was the one thing. It wasn't necessarily that people were buying so much. They were, but it's also because there's just not that much around at any one time. Trader Joe's.
Are there YouTube videos called What to Do Without Toilet Paper?
Yeah, the former Knowles instructors are fine. They got this wired, man. They know what to do.
Well, I would say half of Earth. Earthlings don't even use toilet paper.
That's right. Yeah. So
that always struck me as so fascinating that people were obsessed with toilet paper.
Yeah. But you know, there's also like a lot of the best pasta comes out from Italy, right? Boom, Italy got disrupted, and guess what?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the global thing is it's intricate and it's hard to understand and it's hard to predict. And I think that Trader Joe's had toilet paper longer than anybody in the country. And the reason is they went to an unspecified international hotel chain and said, you guys aren't going to have any business, so we'll buy your toilet paper from you. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a brilliant move. Yeah. I wish I'd have thought of that. I should have asked Lisa at the Lewis and Clark. Hey, Lisa, you got any TV? Yeah.
So the present is always shaping the future, but if it seems like many of us, myself included, we just are like pinballs bouncing around in the world, reactive creatures. And instead of like shaping our future with intention, I think things like a virus give you the opportunity to become more intentional.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to do something with my behavior as a human being that would be healthy, not only for myself and for my family, but for my community, in light of what we're learning from this whole pandemic, That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
I want my thoughts to start to coalesce around more positive sorts of behaviors, you know, that I could exhibit, and that would be helpful to others too.
Yeah, you know, we had our first sort of Zoom management team meeting the other day since this thing started. We have a small group of us, about five of us, that are basically doing the crisis management stuff. And then the rest of the managers have been just sort of responding to what's coming down, right? So we're like, okay, we're putting shields up. We're doing sanitizing. This is what sanitizing looks like. We're going to have – how about if we have somebody sanitizing all the time, right? And that's what we do. Well, I was like, well, what if we run the baskets, all the shopping baskets, after every use through a dish machine, right? And we do that. All the things we could think of – well, a lot of the managers, assistant managers – and I have 22 managers, right? And so – they weren't on that team. They're getting the communication, but they're not driving the effort, right? And so when we had our first sort of virtual meeting the other day, it was really cool to remember that everybody has ideas and things to bring to the table, not just around a crisis situation, but about life, you know, in terms of including each other in stopping and asking, are you okay? I can't tell you how much it means to a worker. Like, we didn't have a revolt of our workers, in part because upper-level management, some of us are working the front lines every day, right? And if you're there with them, you carry them along. And I think that's really true of outside of a virus situation, right? I think that there's been too much sort of assumption that this will be taken care of by a faceless person, and that's fine. and I'm going to go about my jolly way and do my other thing, kind of like what you mentioned, right? I think that it's a really good time for us to think about mindfulness in a giant way, so that it can go anything from thanking a worker, whether it's waving to the dude driving the garbage truck, or the people in the service industry, or whomever. Or just, I've noticed that when the town was in lockdown and I was still going to work every day, I'd ride my bike past people's houses and their faces would be in the window and they'd be waving. It was like they were in an aquarium or something, right? And honestly, I thought that was great. It was like people never used to do that. And then I noticed in those weeks, people were to get out of the house, you'd see couples of people in cars or trucks, and you could tell they're just driving around just to get out. They're just driving around. It's a very American thing. Let's just go for a drive, right? Mm-hmm. But I will say this. We were all waving at the guy on the bike. They didn't used to do that very much. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm optimistic that, there's a thing that you can be pessimistic. I think Dylan wrote, people don't do what they believe in. They just do what's most convenient, and then they repent. that was on Brown's. That was one of his dark songs, right? But I think that it's so easy for our temptation to go that direction, that we just do what's most convenient, and then I repent. I'll change my diet because I got sick or whatever, right? Now that everybody's under this threat, and we all have to work together, I think it's a easier vision for people to do the right thing.
So I tend to agree with that, but I also think without kind of proactive work to try to keep some of those positive actions ongoing, that people are going to backslide, whether it's quickly or slowly. Yes. So either of you guys have any thoughts on, this increased kind of sense of community, positive interactions, thanking people for doing essential work? Choosing to buy the locally owned, locally sourced meat, other food products. Do you have ideas on how we keep these positive actions going once the crisis is over, whenever that is?
I think of it for my organization. I'm not like a community activist person because I'm kind of busy with my day job. And
someone might say managing a food co-op is that.
what we stress is with our managers and our workers is when I said mindfulness, what I mean is every intentional action all the time, stressing that in our organization of kindness and gratitude. And I think that's where it starts. I don't know how it goes from there to a community-wide and region-wide, and then national, whatever, how we're going to do this. I don't have that answer. The answer I have, though, as someone who's had to motivate workers and people for a really long time, is that it's all about how we actually are mindful all the time about how we treat each other. And I think that's gotten really lost in our politics, and I think it's gotten it gets savaged a lot. But those people waving through the windows, there's a real need and desire for people to have more kind interaction and real true being in touch with other people than before this crisis. And so I don't know. I think it starts on a small scale. I think it's an everyday intention, how we do it. It's cutting each other slack. It's being thankful and showing some gratitude all the time. And then I think bigger things come out of that. But I don't have the, I'm not the, if I had a plan, I'd let you know.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thinking, as we're in an election year, at the same time we're dealing with a COVID crisis and we have certain elements trying to find scapegoats.
Yeah.
Whether it's China, people who are being too cautious and too safe and collapsing the economy because they're not willing to go out and expose themselves and their families to disease. How do you kind of counter that attempt to divide politically with the positive messaging and keeping that human connection going.
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, right now we're getting all kinds of nasty posts on Facebook and emails and stuff from people because we're requiring masks of all shoppers, right? And you know, I was called a Nazi this morning, right? Yeah, but well, you know, my decision on how to respond to that, I think is there's an inkling of the answer to your question in that, because if my response to it is not, fighting, get my back up and fight, but instead it's to put my hands together and say, well, you know what, I still wish you the very best.
Right.
You know, and that's our response to people. It's like people are like, I'm never coming back in again. We say, well, you know what, that really, it's a shame because we'll miss you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
We'll miss you. We miss everybody.
Take your time. You might want to rethink that.
Well, I think it's helpful to be able to, you know, one of the positive things is, you know, I don't know who amongst the various chain operations in town is doing it, but I know Costco is requiring masks for every customer as well as employees. So being able to say, well, is this transnational corporation part of the great liberal conspiracy as well? You know, at least there's some examples out there that kind of, if they're used effectively, can shut down the attempts to turn sensible responses to a public health threat into a partisan issue.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we have a saying in our service trainings that we do, which is that, you know, we have to train workers on how to deal with angry or belligerent customers. So I always try to, like, think about, you know, like, what kind of pain are people in? You know, the person who called me a Nazi this morning and is screaming, because, you know, it's like, well, there's a certain, I think, amount of ignorance, but there's also a certain amount of real fear and pain there that it doesn't mean I'm going to be on her side, and it doesn't mean that I'm going to necessarily be all huggy and stuff with her, but it does mean I'm going to try and emphasize, have some empathy and understanding that these people are in pain, and it's too bad, but our job is to be above that and try to bring them up with us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks, Kelly. That's a great note to end on.
Fantastic. Kelly, thank you so much for being in here with us today.
Yeah. Thanks for all your work. Happy to be here. Yeah.
All right. Once again, you've been listening to The View from Here on KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, serving the Gallatin Valley and beyond, and online at kgvm.org. We'll see you next time on The View from Here.